And the next thing I knew, I had plumped up to 170 pounds. So I rejoined Weight Watchers. I got down to 134 pounds. But I could never stay at my weight without being on a diet. Every time I lost weight, I'd go back up, plus another 10. In my head, I could hear my mother saying, "If you're not thin, no one's going to like you." I thought the weight made me who I was. When I was 27, I got pregnant with my oldest daughter. I was afraid of getting any fatter, so I tried to stay on Weight Watchers throughout the pregnancy. But then I got pregnant again 5 months later. I had two babies at home, a new house, so I stayed in and ate. By my second daughter's second birthday, I weighed 230 pounds. I was 30. I joined Weight Watchers again. I only lost about 26 pounds because, of course, I saved all my points for desserts. Every time I allowed sweets to come into the program, my mentality would shift from dieting to hopelessness, and it would be over. 3 years later, I joined again, but I wasn't losing. I was eating sugar. I was eating flour. I could never stay true. I gained it all back. In my early 40s, I started exercising, but all that did was give me permission to keep eating. I maintained a weight between 205 and 215 for about 6 years. I couldn't seem to get below 200. Then, in 2014, I tried Dr. Johnny Bowden's program and lost 24 pounds. But then I went on a cruise vacation, and by the end I was eating full portions of dessert again. I started gaining it back. I just felt so hopeless. Then I found Bright Line Eating. Once I understood that sugar was working like a drug on my brain, honestly, everything was smooth sailing. My biggest challenge was social situations. In my Italian community, I'd have to defend myself and keep saying, "No, thank you, that's not how I eat anymore." I'd have to get belligerent at times because people kept saying, "Oh, just have a little cake, it won't hurt you." Before Bright Line Eating, I would have given in. But now I knew even one bite would hurt me very much. I had to be very direct with my mother and father in particular. But when they finally saw how I was losing weight, they began to understand and started supporting me. In fact, my mother joined me, and now she's lost 25 pounds. Her health has also improved dramatically. My life now is beautiful. I feel in control and very, very energetic. I'm happy with myself. I'm really a different person. I don't have any more aches and pains in my knees and heels. My cholesterol numbers are fabulous. My resting heart rate is better. My blood pressure is low. Best of all, the weight loss has given me so much more confidence. I'm not afraid anymore. I even enrolled in a course and have become a certified life coach. Once I got clear-headed, I realized that I have a lot to give. I want to help people. Bright Line Eating has changed my life.
Part 4. The Roadmap. Staying on Course. Chapter 11. Bright Line Living. Bright Line Eating creates sustainable weight loss because it isn't some crash diet. It's a lifetime weight loss solution. And a lot of things come up over the course of a lifetime. Things that used to involve eating, for happy reasons or sad. I want to equip you with as much information as I can about how to navigate a full and rich life while staying fully happy, thin, and free. I want Bright Line Eating to be sustainable and joyful for you. I don't want you to ever regain your weight. Your happiness is too precious to me, truly. So in these next 3 chapters, we're going to cover the most common things that could crop up and threaten to throw you off your game. I'm going to offer some suggestions on how to handle them. I can't go into as much detail here as I do in the boot camp because that would take volumes, but you will get the essentials. What to expect in the weight loss phase. We touched on this a little bit in Chapter 9, but the reality is that, physiologically speaking, losing weight is really hard on the body, for several reasons. First, we don't actually gain or eliminate fat cells. The ones we've got just expand and contract as our weight fluctuates. And when fat cells shrink, it has big implications for how we feel, because fat cells, it turns out, are the landfills, the storage dumps of the body. They store toxins of all sorts, sometimes literally for years. A fat reservoir in a fat cell doesn't just contain fat. It's also a storage space for toxins. So when you shrink your fat cells, what do those reservoirs do? Well, they migrate over to the cell membrane and then they dump their contents into the bloodstream. The fat gets burned for fuel and the toxins get processed by the liver. All day, every day. Toxins, toxins, toxins. So drink a lot of water to help flush those toxins and expect to feel tired. Also note that you'll be getting a lot of your fuel now from your stored fat, which is not the body's preferred fuel source. Yet another reason why you won't feel in peak form during these brief weight loss months. Part of the tiredness will also come from not eating enough calories to sustain your metabolic needs, but this is why we lose weight. Expect that your metabolism will slow down to somewhere between 70 and 90% of its typical functioning. One of the mechanisms for this metabolic slowdown is a decrease in thyroid hormone, which is the hormone that stokes your metabolic engine. On blood tests, this can look like hypothyroidism. And in a way, it is. But it's temporary hypothyroidism induced by decreased caloric intake. It's what your body wants to be doing, so there's no need to medicate it away. It will reverse naturally when you transition to the maintenance phase and start eating more food again. This is all the body's natural response to weight loss. Make no mistake, weight loss is stressful on the body. But we've got you on a food plan that's going to allow you to keep losing weight for the long term without feeling excessively hungry. You might be wondering, should I be overly concerned about this? Will my metabolism rebound? It's true that there is research that argues that it won't, including a now famous study showing that graduates of The Biggest Loser have metabolisms that have never recovered from the extreme calorie deprivation they were put through. It's important to say that we've never seen evidence of this happening in Brightline eating. After getting down to goal weight and transitioning to maintenance, people are able to eat a surprisingly large amount of food with few cravings and typically little to no hunger. So no, I don't think there's reason for alarm. In the long run, losing the weight is the very best thing you can do for your health. The negative side effects of weight loss are all temporary. I believe that another reason we feel tired in the early days of Brightline eating is that most of us have been habitually using caffeine and sugar to push past our natural limits, to give ourselves that extra pick-me-up. When we can't do that anymore, we can feel like we're hitting a wall. The body finally starts to demand the rest that it has been needing for a very long time. So if you're tired, rest. If you can't rest, at least travel gently. This is where, like I said in Chapter 7, I suggest you imagine you're wearing bunny slippers. That's the kind of attitude I want you to take toward this early weight loss phase, because it's exhausting, but it's temporary. In general, in my experience after coaching thousands of people, it goes away by day 90. Sometimes it lasts longer, but oftentimes it ends well before that. Also, it's true that some people skip the tired phase altogether and begin to feel fantastic as soon as they start Brightline eating. But either way, eventually, Brightline eating results in abundant, overflowing energy with no dips all day long. So hunker down, keep your eye on the ball, and be patient with the process. What to say to people about your weight loss? Your body is going to start changing, and people may begin to ask you about it. It might feel sort of nosy or intrusive, but people don't mean any harm. They're just interested and curious. Your response is really up to you. I always told everyone what I was doing and why, but I'm pretty open. If someone's asking you pointedly why you're not eating this or that, and you really don't want to get into it with them, you could simply say, I found out I have food allergies and sensitivities. This is very true. To say I'm sensitive to sugar and flour is a huge understatement. When I ingest sugar and flour, I break out in obsession, cravings, and obesity. In my book, that's an allergic reaction. I also happen to have experienced abstaining from sugar and flour for long periods of time and then ingesting them again and having really dramatic reactions like flu-like symptoms, hives, headaches, and other physiological effects. So I now really do believe that I'm allergic to sugar and flour. They do not agree with me. But whether it's a metaphor or a physiological reality, either way, it's helpful to be able to say, I've discovered I have food allergies and sensitivities. I've stopped eating sugar and flour, and I find that it's working really well for me. Or if you have any other conditions, arthritis or migraines or insomnia, that you find that Brightline eating has alleviated, you can always fall back on those. So try saying, I experimented with eliminating sugar and flour from my diet, and my headaches have gotten a lot better, so now I'm not eating them anymore. The main thing to keep in mind is that nobody cares that much. People are not focused on you. They're focused on themselves. I want to propose something else also. If somebody seems really interested, it's probably because they have a food issue themselves. So take the opportunity to be helpful to them. Share the roadmap out of the misery and hell of overeating. Even if all you say is, I stopped eating sugar and flour, you will have planted a seed that later might grow into something beautiful. Cooking for a family and the division of responsibility. This is a topic that's dear to my heart because I have three daughters. It's also something I happen to know a lot about because for many years I taught a college course on the psychology of eating, and in that course I included a unit on the psychology of feeding kids. My go-to reference in this domain is a nutritionist named Ellen Satter. She has a philosophy on food that is very different than Brightline eating, so brace yourself if you do decide to look her up. She does not believe in food addiction at all. She believes in what she calls being a competent eater, which means giving yourself permission to eat as much as you want, of whatever you want, in a focused and attentive way when it's mealtime. If you're overweight, she suggests not worrying about it. She and I have talked and have agreed to disagree on this. Competent eating never worked for me, and I believe there are people with highly susceptible brains who will find that it won't work for them either. For people who are low on the susceptibility scale, it may work great. All that said, I do recommend her approach to feeding kids. While I'm aware that thousands of children in the United States are overweight or obese, kids are not grown-ups, so I think it's wrong to steer them, even subtly, into Brightline eating. Brightline eating is a choice people must make on their own. It's a program for people who want it, not for people who need it. But we want to help our kids be healthy eaters. We do. So, what can we do? Well, one of the best things we can do when we're feeding kids is stick to structured meals. And if you're a parent who is adopting Brightline eating, that's wonderful. You're going to be instituting breakfast, lunch, and dinner with a regularity that you might never have done before. And that is going to be a really good thing for the kids in your life. A key idea of Ellen Satter's that I think is essential and that has saved my own sanity when it comes to feeding my kids is something she calls the division of responsibility. This clearly delineates what is my job and what is their job when it comes to food. The job of the parent is to decide when the meal is happening, where it's happening, and what's being served. When, where, and what. But as soon as the food is on the table, the parent's job ends. Then it's the child's job to decide on his or her own how much, if anything, to eat of what's being served. I was very lucky that I learned about the division of responsibility when my firstborns, twin girls, were still infants. I have never in my life pressured my kids to eat anything. Ever. They don't have to eat their vegetables before they can get a bite of whatever they consider to be the good stuff, or before they can leave the table. They don't have to try at least one bite of everything. They don't have to finish what's on their plate. As soon as I've provided the meal, I become blind, deaf, and dumb. I don't even pay attention to what they choose or refuse. What this means is that if part of what I'm serving is starch and all they want to eat that night is rice with butter on it, they can eat that. They can eat that at every meal their whole lives if they want. But the beauty is they don't. What Satter discovered, and I've found to be true as well, is that when you provide a variety of options and then back off, it gives kids the freedom to sneak up on foods, to try them, and to figure out for themselves whether they like them. I never give my kids praise for eating vegetables. I never give them a hairy eyeball for eating nothing but white rice and butter. It's totally up to them. Now, another important part of Satter's philosophy is never to act like a short-order cook. So if they don't like what I'm serving, there will always be another opportunity to eat in a couple of hours. Kids get breakfast, lunch, and dinner, plus sit-down snacks mid-morning and mid-afternoon. My kids will sometimes whine and say, "But I don't like that. There's nothing at this meal that I like to eat." To which I reply, "That's okay, sweetie. You never have to eat anything you don't like." And the conversation ends there because they know it's true. I'm not going to force them to eat, not even one single bite. After dinner in my house, there's never any more food available. My kids know that they don't get to graze all day long. They don't get to walk into the kitchen and just open cupboards and start helping themselves. Now, it might be hard to institute the division of responsibility cleanly if your kids are already older and accustomed to taking what they want from the kitchen whenever they want it. Other than vowing to become an excellent role model and providing good food at meal times, there might not be much you can do at that point. But if you have young kids and you've been putting pressure on them to eat specific foods, know that you can stop putting all that pressure on them. It will help your children become more competent eaters. Plus, it will take that big weight off of your shoulders. What I provide at mealtime to make cooking for a family align with my own Brightline eating foods is a big bowl of starch, plus whatever I'm eating, my protein, my vegetable, my salad, my fruit. Good starch options for kids or any of the adults in your household who aren't doing Brightline eating include white or brown rice, whole grain pasta, kumquat spirals, quinoa, hash browns, and sweet potatoes. Kids do need some amount of starch. They can't just live on protein and vegetables like we can when we're in the weight loss phase. Now, I'm sure that if you're a parent or a grandparent and you've been following along with the science of Brightline eating, you've started to get nervous about what your kids or grandkids are eating. To be honest, I'm nervous about it too. The options that kids are exposed to in restaurants, on kids' menus, and with school lunch programs are horrifying. I do want to reassure you a little bit. For one thing, it's okay for kids to eat flour. Flour is essentially glucose, and glucose causes problems when it's not utilized immediately for fuel. But little kids use up a lot of fuel, so most of the flour they eat is getting turned right into glycogen for their muscles, and they just burn it right off. Sugar is trickier. Here's what I do. I don't provide any fruit juice, and I don't provide any soda or any desserts. There's no expectation at the end of lunch or dinner at my house that there's going to be any kind of dessert, not even fruit. If there's fruit, it's served with the meal. I don't want my kids to think that a wholesome meal needs to be topped off with something sweet. My kids do use real maple syrup on whole grain pancakes. They do use honey, but that's about it. There are never cookies, pies, or brownies hanging around, and no chips or really junky flour-based snacks either. When the kids go out to eat, or to a party, or to a potluck, of course they're confronted with lots of unhealthy options. By and large, my philosophy is not to make a big deal about it. As long as it's not an all-day, everyday thing, research shows that it's not going to rewire their brain. What rewires the brain is constant, chronic access. So as long as I'm providing the opposite, I feel like it's the best I can do. I actually think it's worse to heavily demonize those foods, which has been shown to lead to preoccupation with getting them. My goal is to get my daughters to adulthood acting relatively neutral around food. Of course, I'm conscious of trying to minimize the spread of my own food issues onto them. So I'm very careful, for example, never to talk about my body or my weight or what I'm eating or not eating around them. I also don't let them talk to me about their bodies in an unhealthy way. I started hearing my daughters mention here or there at very young ages that their stomachs were fat or a similar derogatory term. I don't even think they knew what they were saying. They were just parroting what kids at school were saying about themselves. But I shut that right down. "No, thank you," I replied. "No fat talk in our house, please." It stopped happening immediately. Knock on wood. A final word about the food that other people eat. Many of us are concerned about the eating habits of the other adults in our household or in our lives. Here is my general principle. Even if there are really solid reasons why I might think a person I love should want to change the way they're eating, I make it a point not to go there. I stay out of other people's food. The rule of thumb is I keep my eyes on my own plate. This also means that I need to be responsible for my own food, because if I'm living with someone else who's going to be doing some cooking, it's not my business to make them change the way they cook. It's my business to cook my own food. I am responsible for the food that I put into my mouth. End of story. And that includes within the Brightline Eating community. There are plenty of people who are doing Brightline Eating successfully and doing it very differently than I do it. Eating things that I wouldn't eat, for example. Eating them in ways that I wouldn't eat them. Or not eating things that I would eat. Either way, it's none of my business. Honestly, keeping my eyes on my own plate and loving and accepting people no matter what is the only way for me to stay sane. This is also a great example of how Brightline Eating helps us in far more ways than just losing excess weight. We develop better boundaries, become less codependent, and separate out eating from social engagement. Don't let your own triumph be undermined by obsessing over someone else's struggles. Spacing your meals. You might be wondering when you should eat. The general rule of thumb is to try to eat breakfast at breakfast time, lunch at lunchtime, and dinner at dinner time, and to try to space your meals 4 to 6 hours apart. In other words, try not to eat your next meal sooner than 4 hours after the last meal, and try not to wait longer than 6 hours. I do want to say, though, that this is not a bright line. This is really just a guideline. There are times when I eat my next meal sooner than 4 hours, and there are times when I found that I have to space my meals out farther than 6 hours. Life happens sometimes. But in general, the 4 to 6 hour rule is a good guideline. One of the benefits of waiting at least 4 hours between meals is that you will have digested your food from the previous meal more thoroughly. If you eat sooner than 4 hours, you might not have finished digesting the majority of your food, and it's better for the digestive system if you clear out the bulk of the previous meal before adding more. If you have a tricky schedule, for example, you work on a rotating shift, just know that there is always a workable solution for spacing your meals. Here are some of the options people have tried. Option 1, abandon the eat meals at standard mealtimes guideline and go with the 4 to 6 hour rule. So for example, if you work a C shift, eat breakfast within 2 hours of awakening, even if that means breakfast is in the afternoon, and then space out your meals from there. Option 2, abandon the 4 to 6 hour rule. If your work doesn't give you breaks at regular intervals, you may need to go long stretches between meals. And that's okay. No one ever starved to death between meals. Option 3, eat 2 meals a day instead of 3. I know some people for whom this really is the best solution because their work schedule is such that they feel they simply can't eat at work, and their life flows much better when they collapse their food intake into just 2 big meals. In general, I don't recommend this, but I do know people for whom it works. Or finally, eat 4 meals instead of 3. Because similarly, some people just do better if they can split one of their meals into 2, thereby solving, for example, the issue of a workplace that doesn't give them longer than a 10 or 15 minute quick break at any one time, and they simply don't have time to eat a full meal in one sitting. You get the idea. The bottom line is, no matter what your circumstances, I promise there is a way to make it work. Remember that the 4 bright lines are sugar, flour, meals, and quantities. So long as you're eating discrete meals without grazing or snacking in between, you are doing Brightline Eating. It's all good. When you're sick. If you have a cold, you don't need to feed your cold, but you don't need to starve it either. Just keep sticking to your regular food plan. However, if you've got the flu or a stomach bug and are vomiting, it's a bit of a different story. I do recommend that you still try to keep to a three-meal structure, but you'll probably want to change up the foods you're eating. Try having a breakfast meal for all three meals, because foods like oatmeal and bananas might stay down when chicken and salad will not. And obviously, this is one case when the finish your food rule goes out the window. If you can only choke down one bite of oatmeal, for goodness sake, stop. Broth is fine if it's weighed and measured at 8 ounces and consumed at mealtime. But the bright lines still apply. No ginger ale, no saltine crackers. A note about colonoscopies. I have never known anyone to be triggered by drinking that stuff, so go right ahead and comply with the instructions. If they say you can only ingest clear fluids before the test, take them on a three-meal-a-day structure. Broth or white cranberry juice diluted with equal parts water, plus the prep solution, is fine. Making substitutions. The power of Brightline eating to bridge the willpower gap is that we avoid making decisions about what to eat in the moment based on how we feel. So we never ever change up our food because we've opened the fridge and thought, I don't feel like bell peppers right now. I think I'll have asparagus instead. There's no integrity in that. However, there are some legitimate reasons for making substitutions to your food plan. For example, if you've written down fish for lunch and noon comes, you open the fridge and you discover the fish is rancid, then A, don't eat it, and B, don't drive to the store to buy more fish. Find a different protein, throw it on the scale, and get on with your life. Second, there's something I like to call the mom exception. So, say I've written down roasted chicken, sliced peppers and onions, and salad for dinner. But then my daughter develops an ear infection and I spend the afternoon at the pediatrician's office followed by a wait at the pharmacy. I arrive home at 6:30 p.m. and there's no way I'm starting to slice onions at that point. It's time to open a can of corn and put a frozen veggie burger in the microwave. Now, not order a pizza, mind you. Just choose more rough and ready Brightline foods. Now, if you don't have kids, you'll probably come across your own version of an unanticipated situation at some point and decide that the sane thing to do is to swap out your pre-committed food for a simpler menu. And that's fine. And finally, some social factors just make changing your food in the moment the right thing to do. But knowing when and how to activate this option requires some wisdom and perspective. These days, if the evening comes, we've been cooped up in the house all day, and my husband turns to me and says, "Want to go out for Mexican food?" I have no problem saying, "Sure." I've eaten Brightline meals at Mexican restaurants for years, and making a last-minute swap there feels fine and doable to me. Mind you, I don't do it every day. And in the first couple of years of my journey, I did not make those kinds of last-minute changes. I would instead eat what I'd committed to, and then perhaps plan a dinner out with him for the next day or over the weekend when I could commit to it in advance. It took me a long time to earn back the right to make spontaneous food choices. That said, even in the early days, if I was out with girlfriends on the town and due to factors outside my control, we ended up needing to stop at a restaurant because it was really mealtime, then yes, I would eat a lunch out. The most important thing is to not skip meals, or you might open the door for your saboteur to convince you to eat more food later. Hunger and fullness. I want to talk to you about two common bugaboos that have the potential to derail your Brightline eating program and how to make friends with them. The first is hunger, and the second is fullness. I propose to you that hunger is not an emergency, and neither is being really full. They are just sensations, and you can get used to them and develop a certain level of comfort with both of them. A lot of folks start Brightline eating having eaten so much, so often, that it's actually been a long time since they've really felt hungry, physiologically speaking. And the only times they realized that they were truly hungry, they immediately went to solve the problem by eating something. Now, in Brightline eating, we don't do that. We wait until mealtime to eat. And it's entirely likely and possible that you're going to get hungry before it's time to eat your next meal, especially while you're on the weight loss food plan. You're not going to be eating enough food to meet your metabolic needs, which is why you're going to be burning fat stores and losing weight. Under these conditions, hunger is absolutely possible. It is true that some people do go through the Bright Line eating weight loss phase and report never feeling hungry. Other people report getting hungry pretty reliably an hour or two before mealtimes. And a rare few feel very, very hungry a whole lot. But no matter how you slice it, hunger is not an emergency. It's merely an interesting sensation in the body. But if you don't feel that way, if hunger instills some amount of panic in you, I encourage you to analyze why. Maybe journal about it or learn to make friends with it. It's not excruciatingly painful. It's actually kind of cute in a grumbly little way. It's just this little tickle in the tummy. And the neat thing is that it actually usually goes away. 15 minutes or half an hour later, it can be completely gone, and not because you've eaten anything, just because hunger comes and then goes. Often something simple like a glass of water or a cup of herbal tea will help. So I encourage you to start thinking about hunger in a different way. Breathe into it. See what comes up for you when you ask yourself why it frightens you so much. And the twin cousin of hunger is fullness. Now, granted, I'm someone who actually likes to be really, really full. Before Bright Line eating, I found something really comforting about that Thanksgiving full belly feeling. But I've worked with people long enough to know that some people feel awful when they're very full. Some folks have reported that the meal size we need to eat in Bright Line eating is enough to produce that uncomfortable sensation for them. If you have a history of bulimia and the feeling of being too full is a powerful trigger for you, then definitely cut back the quantities of vegetables a little bit, especially at dinner. And once again, I would encourage you to just sit with that uncomfortable feeling and try to make friends with it. Accept it. Journal about it. What is it about the feeling of being full that is so scary or uncomfortable to you? What does it bring up for you? In the past, it's likely that you've reacted to hunger or fullness in a way that didn't ultimately serve your best interests. You now have an opportunity to change that. Food thoughts and mantras. Similarly, you can change how you think about all the not my food that's out there in the world. Mantras are a good way to do that. A mantra is any phrase that we codify, imbue with power, and call upon when needed. I have three that have been really helpful to me in my Bright Line eating journey. The first is, don't eat no matter what. No matter what, just don't eat. Of course, I don't mean become anorexic. I mean, don't eat any bite of food that's not on my food plan. This can be a very comforting, repetitive mantra if I'm going through a rough afternoon and driving or walking past temptations. Don't eat no matter what, no matter what, just don't eat. The next mantra that I found to be really helpful when offered food at parties is, that's not my food, that's poison to me. I don't say it out loud, just silently to myself. And reframing those foods not as delicious treats but as deadly poisons is very effective and, frankly, very truthful. For me, those foods do poison my life. They poison my body. They warp my mind with cravings and obsessions. They lower my self-esteem. They make me sick. They will make me die decades or years earlier if I continue to eat them the way I did before. They are poison to me. The third mantra is, thank you, God, that's not my food. If you don't want any God in there, you could just say, thank goodness that is not my food, or just, that is not my food. In our online support community, this mantra has morphed into a phrase we use often, not my food. This is oftentimes abbreviated as NMF. No need to even dignify it by spelling it out. It's all just NMF, and you don't have to give it the time of day. These mantras are part of a more global discussion, which I think is worth having, about our mental fortitude and not my food. I'll tell you a story to illustrate what I mean. I was in Sydney, Australia, 6 months after I started this way of life, and I had only 5 pounds left to lose. I was exhausted from severe hypothyroidism that was not being properly treated, and the desire to eat had come home to roost. I was battling cravings, valiantly, nearly all day every day. But up until that point, I was battling them successfully. One day, I was waiting at the bus stop so I could make my way to the University of New South Wales, where I was working as a postdoctoral research fellow. I was standing in front of a cafe that had cakes in the window, layers of cakes. And typically, when I stood at that bus stop, I would walk to the next shop, which I think was a bookstore or something, to stand there so I wouldn't have to stand in front of those cakes. But I was so exhausted and so homesick that day that I just allowed myself to stare through the window at those cakes. I didn't just look at them, I studied them. I fantasized about how one might taste and how that other one might smell and which one I would get if I were going to go eat one. In my mind, it was all completely hypothetical. I even remember saying to myself, I'm doing this, but I'm safe because I'm not going to eat them. I'm just looking. I got on the bus and I went to work. The next day, I was waiting at that bus stop again, and I walked in and ordered a cake. I didn't just stop after one piece either. I kept eating. Just like that, I was off on a 3-month tear of gaining back all my weight and then some. I went from a size 4 to a size 24 in 3 months. It was the most painful time of my entire life. I simply could not stop eating. Finally, a few months later, I did get back on my program. I lost all the weight again, and I have stayed slender ever since. And what I learned from that experience is that thoughts are very powerful. I simply cannot afford to let myself fantasize about food. As soon as I catch myself mentally wandering into the land of not my food, I shut my mind against those thoughts. That is not my food. That's poison to me. Don't eat no matter what. No matter what, just don't eat. Bookending. To end this chapter, I want to talk about a little trick that can help you in any of the sticky situations where you're worried that you might pick up a bite of food that's not on your food plan. This includes things like going to the movies for the first time since starting Brightline Eating, grocery shopping at a place with delectables, attending a wedding, or going to a friend's house for dinner. You get the idea. When you know that you'll be facing a tricky situation like that, I encourage you to use a powerful tool called bookending. Bookends go on either side of a row of books on the bookshelf, right? So when you bookend an event, here's what it looks like. Let's say that the event in question is a wedding. Before the wedding, you could text your buddy or post in the Brightline Eating online support community, I'm going to a wedding tonight and I'm concerned because I haven't ever been to a wedding without eating not my food before. I think it's going to be tempting, but I have my emergency action plan firmly in mind and I commit to activating it if I get really tempted. At the end of the event, you come back into the online support community or you text your buddy again and you say, I stuck to my bright lines, feeling awesome. Thank you for your support. Just knowing in advance that you're going to bookend it, that you're going to report your triumph back to the Brightline Eating community or to your buddy, will see you through.
Case study, Meg Quior. Highest weight, 261 pounds. Current weight, 125 pounds. Height, 5 feet 2 inches. Many of my childhood memories involve food. One of my early memories is of me sneaking into my grandma's pantry to eat clumps of brown sugar out of the bag. Later in childhood, I clearly remember feeling comforted by food and using it to ease my anxiety. By the time I was a teenager, even though only modestly overweight, I was put on diet pills and the grapefruit diet. The need to lose weight was deeply woven into my sense of self. In my 20s, I'd do things like eat only one yogurt a day. I'd lose 5 or 6 pounds, but it was never sustained. How could it be? Through my 30s and 40s, my eating continued to expand. I tried every diet fad and plan on the market. Weight Watchers, repeatedly. Pritikin, Atkins, the Mediterranean diet, Jenny Craig, as a lifetime member, even a 12-step group. You name it. I tried it. I would have short-lived, modest success and then regain all the weight, plus more. By my 50s, my weight had climbed well above 200 pounds. I began taking blood pressure medication. My mobility was increasingly compromised, and I needed bilateral knee replacements. I felt utterly hopeless about ever finding a way out of my issues with food and weight, until a friend connected me to Susan's work. Brightline eating helped where nothing else had, not even a 12-step program for food addiction. The difference for me was that Brightline eating explained the brain science behind food addiction. Susan didn't just tell me to do something. She explained why I should do it. For me, that has made all the difference. Before Brightline eating, I called myself a sugar junkie, thinking it was a metaphor, and not realizing that I was hitting the nail on the head. Brightline eating has been a miracle for me. Within a week, my cravings disappeared. As Susan explained each tool of the program, I picked it up and put it in my pocket. My weight steadily declined. Now my hunger is well met by my food intake. I enjoy my meals. I'm satisfied. I'm grateful. I move on. After losing 85 pounds, I happened upon a picture of myself at my heaviest, and it was a revelation. I realized there was some very powerful denial at work that prevented me from fully engaging with my lived reality at the time. It was obvious to everyone else, I'm sure, and in some sense I knew it was a burden. But at my heaviest, I didn't actually see the weight I carried when I looked in the mirror. To have that reality hit me was quite jarring, and it makes me appreciate the complexity of denial and addiction. At goal, I weigh half of what I weighed when I started. I am a slow but steady loser, so it has taken a while, but that's okay. The journey has been profound. In many ways, it's been easy for me. I don't struggle. I just work the program pretty effortlessly, every day. My well-being has improved across the board. I'm off all medications. My blood work falls in healthy ranges. My blood pressure has gone down. And my newfound mobility is a surprising gift every single day. Recently, I've been thinking a lot about Heavy Meg, who she was and how she felt. It's important to me that I honor her, not reject or deny her. I no longer judge her. I'm learning to be compassionate toward myself, both at the size I was then and at the size I am now. At age 65, and in a right-sized body, life is opening up in rich, deeply satisfying, surprising ways. I have a zest for life that I haven't known in decades, and for the first time in my entire life, I am at peace with my food. I'm convinced that Brightline eating is saving my life. I'm deeply, incredibly grateful.
Chapter 12. Restaurants, Travel, and Special Occasions. Brightline living is meant to be resilient and flexible enough that you can do it for the rest of your life in the real world with minimal sacrifice. Personally, I am a very social animal. I eat out, I celebrate many holidays with my faith group, and I travel frequently for both work and pleasure. And yet, I absolutely stick with my bright lines. It is possible to have it all. It does, however, require some extra preparation and planning. In this chapter, we'll be covering living a bright line life outside your home. Restaurants. Honestly, I recommend that you avoid eating out for your first 30 days, if you can. It's very helpful to establish the habit of Brightline eating before venturing into a restaurant. Eating out is totally possible, but it will always be a bit more difficult to navigate than a meal at home. Most notably because you won't be bringing your food scale to restaurants and you'll have to eyeball your quantities. Doing this honestly and without using it as an opportunity to overeat can present an ongoing challenge for some people. It takes scrupulous honesty to not overeat in a restaurant. If you get a too large, too oily meal many times a week, it will keep you fat and ultimately miserable, so it's worth it to learn clean habits in restaurants early on. Don't fudge. You'll want to choose your restaurants carefully. Go online and look at the menu ahead of time, if at all possible. Your goal is to find something to eat in each food category on your food plan. For example, if you're still losing weight and following the weight loss food plan, for dinner you need protein, a cooked vegetable, and a salad. If you eat meat, a steakhouse is usually a safe bet because you'll be able to easily get all three of those things. When you're out to eat, if they don't have any options for one of your categories of food, sometimes you can make some limited substitutions. For example, I like to say produce is produce, meaning you can swap raw for cooked vegetables or vegetables for fruit. For lunch, if the restaurant doesn't have fresh fruit, you can substitute a salad. However, if you're at goal weight and they don't have a grain that you can eat, you'll have to let it go for that meal. You will want to order carefully. Let the server know that you don't eat flour or sugar. Order your salad with no croutons, no cheese, and oil and vinegar on the side. If you're not sure what's in something, ask. Request that the food be prepared simply with no sauces. Make sure fish or chicken is not dipped in flour or breaded. On occasion, you may have to send your food back. On my 29th birthday, just a few weeks after I first started following this way of eating, my husband and I were vacationing in New York City. We were in Little Italy in Manhattan, walking around and looking for a nice restaurant. Men with thick accents standing in front of Italian restaurants kept trying to sweet-talk us into their establishments. We looked at a lot of menus. I chose a restaurant that had Chilean sea bass, my favorite fish. I ordered very carefully. I told the waiter I didn't eat flour or sugar and asked him to please grill my fish without dipping it in flour first. The food took forever to come out. We'd been walking all day, and I felt weak and famished by the time it arrived at the table. To my dismay and my husband's incredulity, my fish arrived fully breaded. Normally, I would go ahead and speak up for myself, but in this instance, my husband was so blown away by their error that he spoke up. He said, "She said she doesn't eat any flour," to which the waiter replied, "This is not flour. This is not flour. This is bread." I always laugh when I think about that night, but it wasn't funny at the time. Now that so many people are following gluten-free lifestyles, that kind of confusion probably doesn't happen often anymore. Take it as a warning, though, to always clearly specify what you can and cannot eat. When the food arrives, before you start eating, eyeball your portions. Typically, the salad and vegetables won't be large enough, and the protein serving will be too big. Ask God to help you see clearly, or invoke your own highest, most honest nature. Then make a cut in the meat so that you have 4 ounces if you're female, or 6 ounces if you're male. Then take the rest off your plate and put it on a side plate. Ask for one if you need to. In addition to remembering to pray, the trick I use to keep myself honest in restaurants is to imagine myself in a food weighing contest, similar to the guess how many jelly beans are in the jar contest at state fairs. When I'm guessing a quantity in a contest, I'm really trying to get it right. I want to win the prize. In a restaurant, I imagine that I'm trying to get my estimated weights as accurate as possible so that my entry will be the winning one. In my boot camp, I have the time and space to go in-depth on each cuisine. But in brief, Mexican, Chinese, Thai, Japanese, Indian, and yes, even Italian restaurants are all doable. Here are some basic tips. At a taqueria, it's pretty easy to get a burrito bowl instead of a tortilla, and then have them add ingredients according to the categories you get in your food plan. Again, estimating quantities is the hardest part, so make it easy on yourself by ordering just one type of protein, and then ask for lots of cooked vegetables, like salsa, corn, lettuce, etc. Since you'll be combining your 6 ounces of fruit and 6 ounces of vegetables for lunch into 12 ounces of vegetables, or 6 ounces of vegetables and 8 ounces of salad into 14 ounces of vegetables for dinner, you can pretty much ask them to load up the rest of your bowl with whatever kind of produce they have. Then ask for guacamole or sour cream if you prefer for your fat, and voila. If you're at a sit-down Mexican restaurant, fajitas are usually a safe bet. Hold the tortillas. Again, stick with one protein source. If you're getting chicken fajitas, leave off the cheese and beans. At a Chinese or Thai restaurant, you can order vegetables with either meat or tofu, but you'll have to carefully ask for no sugar, flour, or cornstarch in the sauce. I've found that one plate of food in an Asian restaurant is typically actually the right amount of food for one meal. Japanese restaurants can be really tricky because they hide sugar in a lot of things. The salad dressing is likely to have sugar, but they may not have oil and vinegar available on the side, so you may have to just let the salad dressing go. Sushi rice has sugar in it, but if you're on the maintenance plan, you can order sashimi and a plain bowl of rice. A side order of edamame makes a great protein serving if you don't like sashimi. A side dish called ohitashi is basically boiled spinach. It makes a great vegetable serving if you order it without the sauce. If they have a hibachi grill, then you'll be all set, since a hibachi dinner comes with protein, vegetables, rice for those in the maintenance phase, and typically some kind of salad. Just ask for the dressing on the side. But be careful to state that you don't want them to use teriyaki sauce on the grill, because it's loaded with sugar. Indian restaurants work well, especially for lunch buffets, but they will be oilier meals than you would cook at home, so you shouldn't eat there often during the weight loss phase. Avoid the makhani sauce dishes. They contain sugar. If you're plant-based, you'll find dal, which is lentils, or chana masala, chickpeas, for your protein. And if you're meat-based, they'll have some kind of chicken, goat, lamb, or beef. And there will be vegetable dishes. But if you're still in the weight loss phase, be sure to avoid the vegetable dishes that are loaded with potatoes. Now, by Italian, I don't mean just a pizza place. That won't work unless they have really bountiful salads. Opt for grilled fish, chicken, or steak, with a side of garlic spinach and a salad. There are two sayings that should become your dining out mantras. Less is more, and when in doubt, leave it out. The goal is to leave the restaurant feeling free, not second-guessing what you just ate. If you find yourself thinking about the meal at all after it's over, that's your conscience niggling at you. Journal about it, or go talk with your mastermind group or buddy and figure out what you're going to do differently next time. Create a next time I will contingency plan to help you navigate the situation in the future. For example, next time I order fajitas, I will ask for a clean plate and move the sizzling meat and vegetables onto it so I won't be tempted to scrape up every bit of the greasy oil with my spoon. Travel. If there's one cardinal rule of traveling when you're a Brightline eater, it's plan ahead. Plan, plan, plan. There's a great saying about this. If you fail to plan, you've planned to fail. And it's so true. But the opposite is true, too. With a little forethought, traveling can be really easy and totally lovely. Here are some of the ways that I plan ahead when I'm doing Brightline eating. Calling ahead. If I'm going to be staying in a hotel, I call ahead to find out if I can have a microwave and a refrigerator in my room. If not, that's okay, but it affects the foods I'll choose to bring along. If you're going to a conference or traveling with a tour group, call ahead to find out what they'll be serving for any meals they'll be providing for you. Are the lunches just sandwiches in a box? That's not going to be so helpful. If it's a buffet salad bar with all sorts of veggies and beans, you'll easily be able to make Brightline choices. With just a couple of phone calls to caterers and event planners, you can find out if you'll need to bring your own food and how much you'll have to plan for. Oftentimes, they'll be happy to provide you with a special meal. Once you've made the call, you can relax. Where to stay. If I have control over my accommodations, I prefer to stay in a place where I have access to kitchen facilities. Airbnb has been a game changer for the Brightline eating community. Most extended stay hotels have kitchenettes. Or you could stay with friends or family so that you have access to their kitchen. Hotels work, but having a kitchen is nicer. Breakfast on the road. In general, when I travel, I pack my own breakfast. I just feel like it's easier to start off my day with a meal I don't have to think about. I save that energy for lunch or dinner out. I always bring my digital food scale when I travel. I also bring several ingredients pre-weighed from home. My favorite travel protein is a 2-ounce baggie consisting of mixed nuts, roasted edamame, and roasted chickpeas. Note that men would get 3 ounces. For breakfast in a hotel, I'll do one of those baggies, plus 1 ounce of shredded wheaten bran or Fiber One, and add my own fruit from home, typically an apple because they're easy to transport. If you do have a microwave and a refrigerator and you want to bring oatmeal or hard-boiled eggs, those are also great options. Packing all your meals. There have been times I've gone to a weekend conference, maybe even a 4-day event, and decided that I just didn't feel like eating every lunch and dinner in a hotel restaurant. So instead, I've literally packed all my food. Veggies, proteins, fruits, grains, the whole kit and caboodle. It's doable. It's also a good option for people who are really sensitive to oil and salt, perhaps because of a heart condition or GERD. Bringing several days' supply of your own food is an option. There are two main approaches to doing this. The first is to weigh and measure all of your food before you go and to pack each individual meal into its own Tupperware container. This works best on a road trip where you can bring a big cooler in your car. When you're at the hotel, you can wheel it down the hall and replenish the ice from the ice machine and then use the drain nozzle thing at the bottom to drain it into the bathtub as the ice melts. When flying, bring your food in the original packaging, not weighed and measured yet, and then bring your digital food scale plus some travel containers. You can weigh it all when you get there. Packing none of your meals. It's possible not to bring any food when you're traveling, especially if you're a seasoned Brightline traveler. You might decide to just trust. I've done this plenty and been just fine, but I've traveled a lot. I've taken over 100 trips since beginning Brightline eating. I will go to any length to find a Brightline meal, and deep down, I trust myself to do it. I am not going to cave and eat whatever is being served if it's got sugar and flour in it or if it's not mealtime. I'm just not going to. Even if it's the end of the day and my willpower is shot and everything's gone wrong and the rental car broke down and my suitcase is lost and it's dinner time and there's a pizza stand right there, I'm just not going to go there. I've built up integrity and trust in myself, but it's taken time. If you're new to Brightline eating, I don't recommend going on a trip without a clear idea of where your Brightline meals are going to come from. It's just not wise. Do what you have to do to protect your precious, precious Brightline program. It's worth it. Once you've become a seasoned traveler, you might still choose to revert to a more cautious approach to taking trips if you have other stressors going on in your life. I experienced this just recently, after the Brightline eating movement started to explode, and suddenly I found myself with dozens of employees and thousands of people wanting my time and complicated online technologies to figure out, my willpower was tapped by decision fatigue in a way I had never before experienced. Because of this, I had to stop eating out so much when I traveled. I had to go back to the basics and call ahead, ask what was being served, and go the extra mile to ensure that I would have zero choice points during my trip. I also had to start taking my digital food scale with me into restaurants, and even in my own hometown. It might feel weird to you at first to bring your scale into a restaurant, but I promise you, as you slip your scale under the plate, no one's watching. Check my recommended travel scales at the website book.brightlineeating.com. Weighing food in restaurants can actually be really freeing. It's worth it to take the load off that future moment when your willpower might be missing in action. The general lesson for traveling is plan in advance. Flying. If I know I'm going to be on an airplane at mealtime, I always bring my food. I simply do not trust that I'm going to be able to get a Brightline meal on an airplane. The TSA will allow you to bring food onto an airplane. What you probably can't do if you're going through customs at the end is to take that food off of the plane. You can't bring fruit or produce into a foreign country. Now, what the TSA doesn't allow are liquids or gels, so don't pack yogurt because that's a gel. Don't bring little containers of salad dressing either. Just bring it all mixed in already. Plant-based foods that travel well. Proteins. Little sandwich baggies of nuts, seeds, roasted chickpeas, and roasted edamame, also known as soy nuts, travel very well. There are also now vacuum-packed pouches of things like chickpeas in an Indian flavoring sauce, basically just what you would get in an Indian restaurant, by the brand Tasty Bite. You just rip it open and heat. It's perfectly good food. It only needs to be refrigerated after it's opened. The pouches can go right in your suitcase. Grains. If you're on the maintenance food plan, you get grains with lunch and dinner. Seeds of Change makes